My very special guest today is none other than the famous filmmaker Chris Everard. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hello, Vinny. It's nice to be with you.
It's a stellar opportunity that we have in front of us here, and by us, I mean me, to interview you. Now, if you would be so kind as to fill out the first part of the interview here by explaining your website to people and who you are and what it is you do.
Right. Well, I wrote my first book in 1984. I really basically can't remember the first time when I was interested in esoteric, spiritual, and extraterrestrial subjects. I mean, it goes right the way back to when I was a little boy. Maybe I was about 4 or 5 years old. And my grandfather was a member of the Sovereign Military Order of the Knights of Malta, which is a Masonic organization that is linked to MI6 and the Vatican. And when I was growing up as a little boy, we had about 30 or 40 of his medals on the wall at home. And I always asked my mum, what are those medals? And she said, oh, that's when your granddad was in the Royal Air Force. And anyway, I wanted to have a closer look at them. I got a ladder one day when I was on my own, and everyone was at work. I got a step ladder out, and I climbed up the step ladder to have a look at these medals, and there wasn't a single medal there from the Royal Air Force. They were all medals from Masonic organizations that had KOM, Knights of Malta, on them, and they had bull's heads and stars of David and various weird emblems, and it just got me interested. And then my first job, I had a Saturday job at a hi-fi store, and I remember going to this store on the bus, and the bus went past a Masonic temple, and I saw one of these symbols that was on one of my grandfather's medals. And I thought, oh, there's buildings with these symbols on the outside of the building. I was about 12, 13, and that got me interested at a very early age. And I started writing books, and I started publishing my own magazine. And I was publishing articles about the Bavarian Illuminati and different secret societies and brotherhoods on the bulletin board BBS system. That's more or less a kind of early version of the internet. And I built up a magazine publishing business in my spare bedroom, and I sold it to a big publishing company in England. And I invested the money into broadcasting documentaries and TV shows on the internet. And I had a meeting with Apple Computer in 1998. And I told them what I was going to do. And they said, well, we haven't got any technology that allows you to do it yet. And I said, don't worry, I'll get something sorted out and I'll do it myself. And I did. And we started test transmissions in 1998. And my first documentary films were about the secret space program and about crop circles and UFOs. And I made those films. And this is in the days of VHS. There was no DVD in those days. And I built up a mailing list of people that were interested in my research. And in those days, you used to have to email your articles to people because the internet was only running at 28 kilobytes per second. Websites used to take, about 4 or 5 minutes to load each page, and you couldn't have very large images. But through all of that, we managed to get the Enigma channel going, and there's been 10.5 million subscribers since 1999. We were broadcasting video before everyone else, and it was launched at the Royal Television Society in 1999. So that's basically what I do.
Now, it's interesting that you say you published your first book in 1984. That was the year I was born.
Yeah.
It's an ominous year.
Well, because of Orwell, yeah. George Orwell wrote his book in 1948, and he reversed the last two digits. So if he'd written his book a year later, in 1949, it would have ended up being called, you know, that's how he came up with the title 1984.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to work at the BBC, just on and off as a freelance recording engineer. I used to earn money, some friends of mine at school, they ended up working at Abbey Road Studios, owned by EMI. And they got me, you know, various little jobs there. And I used to earn a little bit of money as an audio recording engineer, recording orchestras for film soundtracks.
Yeah, that sounds like quite prestigious work. And are you still operating at that kind of level now? Because I found a lot of people, when they do work in professional industries, but they retain something that a lot of those industries are missing, like a conscience, the work starts to dry up. You start to have to become even more independent. And it becomes not about a choice, but a lack of options.
I've known about the so-called New World Order and brotherhoods and corruption within those networks of brothers for a long time. I've always written articles where I've kind of seeded this information into the articles. I've written more than 1,000 reviews of professional broadcast equipment. And my magazine publishing business used to actually publish a magazine for, you know, television and radio bosses, really, and all the top technical engineers in the broadcast industry worldwide. And so I was always feeding information about the Illuminati into those articles. And, I think the thing is that, my first book was published when I was 19. So I've had independent amounts of money to be able to, you know, broadcast, publish, and now I have, you know, my company that we publish books, we publish magazines, we publish ebooks, we have a radio network, we have a television network, and we have a movie studio. So I'm able to actually not worry about censorship, but I do not like the way that my films are being butchered and mutilated and distorted on video sharing websites. And many people believe that they've seen my films on various video sharing websites. What they've actually seen is they've seen a butchered and censored version of one of my films, because many of the actual files that are out there in the public domain, and I've never, ever uploaded any of my films to any video sharing website, have actually been censored. And it's usually the very last 10 minutes of my documentaries where I sum up everything. And this has led a lot of people astray. And it gives them the wrong end of the stick. And then there's a whole kind of fake author industry of people who, you know, claim various weird career paths and things that don't exist. And they kind of see my films and then they plagiarize the information. And it's like Chinese whispers. And, that's why I don't like video sharing websites, basically.
Well, I think it's a natural reaction to protect your interests, because if your good name is being despoiled by scumbaggery agents of the very people that you're trying to expose, can't leave a sweet taste on the tongue, can it?
Not really, no. Yeah, and, you know, yeah, it's just led people astray. It's not only led the public astray. As I said, it's triggered off this weird kind of gaggle of strange researchers and authors who've got the wrong end of the stick and don't actually understand a lot of what they're talking about.
Well, you say,
you know,
that
their idea of research is watching YouTube videos. My idea of research is traveling the world, and I've taught myself French. I speak quite a lot of Spanish. I've taught myself bits of Latin. I taught myself Sumerian. And, you know, like, for example, the Nag Hammadi texts, which were found in Egypt, 1947, I actually went to Egypt when there was a bloke sitting outside with a machine gun and a 4-inch thick plate of lead. And it was in the middle of the Spring Revolution, 2011. And I went there specifically to go to the source of the information. And I've also taught myself a little bit of Aramaic as well. If you talk to, and I've interviewed, and I've had a lot of these types of people as guests in my documentary films, if you ask them, do you understand, you know, Aramaic or French, forget it. you know, so unfortunately, that's the situation. I wish that it was a different situation. I wish that there were more people who would go to the source of the information. But they don't seem to do that. They get their information from other people's books.
It becomes, as you rightly put, Chinese whispers.
Yeah.
And I think what is happening globally, we're actually seeing almost a nexus point of these kind of disinformation, misinformation sort of movements. And every single conceivable conspiracy direction you can think of, without anybody knowing any of the truth whatsoever, they believe the lies, because it's a hell of a lot what was it Mark Twain said? It's much easier to convince somebody of a lie than to convince them that they've been lied to.
Oh, that's interesting. I've not heard that quote from him. He also said, if you tell the truth, you don't need to have a script. You don't need to remember anything if you just tell people the truth, which is, you know, there's a lot of truth in there.
Indeed. And what people don't get is the value of raw, unfiltered, straightforward, from the source truth. These are the things that are actually inherently valuable in and of themselves. Everything else, I think, is it's like, you know, when you have your first birthday, you have one candle, then you have two candles, and then you get a little bit older, and you're like, it's actually too much effort to put 40 candles on the cake. What the hell is the point? you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely, it's true. Yeah,
and the thing is, you just look at the fact. You don't need to record it. Oh, it needs to be absolutely so accurate, etc., that nobody can ever argue with it. This is what people are actually thinking, that there is no such thing as objective truth.
Well, it goes further than that. I mean, people are being told that the entire universe, the planet Jupiter, the moon, us, every living creature on our planet does not exist. People are being told that it's a process of your mind. And of course, this tactic of telling people who become disciple kind of followers has been used throughout the ages. It's what all messiahs, it's what all saviors do. It's what everyone in the Edwardian, Georgian, and Victorian eras, when there was an upsurge of interest in the occult teachings of India and the Himalayas, this is what all of those people did. I'm talking about Helena Blavatsky, Ledbetter, Rudolf Steiner, to a certain degree, and lots of the other kind of psychics, fortune tellers, mystics. Gurdjieff is another one. They get to a point where they basically rely on a narrow selection of texts. One of the most popular ones is called the Kybalion. And the Kybalion has a little line in there, which they take literally. And it says, the mind is everything. Well, the mind is obviously an extraordinarily fantastic and potent and amazing phenomenon within the creative force of the universe and creation and evolution. But the mind did not exist before the universe. And I've studied astronomy. I've studied astronomy at the University of Greenwich in London. And, you know, I have a very, very big telescope. I built my own kind of space observatory. And, you know, I use sophisticated astronomical equipment. And I can see with my equipment, you know, detail. I can not only see Jupiter, I can see the moons of Jupiter. And when I see people being told, oh, that's all a figment and it doesn't exist and it's just a perception, I think, well, you know, hang on there, all right? Because the human brain is the product of evolution. And planet Earth is 4.5 billion years old. The universe has been dated back to about 13.7 billion years old. And the human brain in its current form, Homo sapiens sapiens, which is us, Homo erectus, the Neanderthals, Cro-Magnon, has gone through an evolutionary period of time, which we can date back probably 115 to 250,000 years. And that's it. There was no human brain to perceive the existence of our planet, which formed about 4.5 billion years ago.
What I found was disturbing about this line of thought was to say that I can create my reality. And I'm thinking, you can create your entire reality. Really? What do? Cancel out the 700 billion other people, 7 billion other people that are also manifesting their reality? You just cancel them out because you're that powerful?
Well, absolutely. And obviously, you know, when you look through a telescope, you're looking back in time. And when you look at the nearest galaxy to our galaxy, which is the Andromeda galaxy, which, by the way, is on a collision course with our galaxy, and the Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxy will end up becoming a super galaxy. What you're actually seeing when you look through a big telescope and you're seeing the light of the stars from the Andromeda galaxy is you're seeing light which began its journey long, long, long ago. Some of those photons of light coming down the telescope began their journey when there were dinosaurs walking the Earth. Now, you know, basically, I'm sorry to say this, and you know, a lot of people get very kind of agitated, really, because they've woken up, they've realized that the political class of politicians, the lords, the congressmen, the senators are basically in it for themselves and they're all corrupt and they've woken up to that and that's good. And they've gone through an awakening stage. They've realized that really mainstream news is really a selection of channels for what I describe as neo-fascist propaganda coming from the royal political corporate elite. And they've woken up to that, which is good. But then, as they've woken up from whatever dogma they were believing in, maybe, for example, they were Catholics before, or maybe they were, you know, born-again Christians, or maybe they were Mormons before, maybe they were just working-class people who, you know, just sat at home watching soap operas when they came home from work. They've woken up from that, but then they've been sold a bunch of lies by, you know, various people, you know, that are basically telling them that the whole of reality is created by them, like you just said, and nothing is real, apart from, of course, what they're being told by that person. Oh, that's real.
Yeah. And that person also exists, even though nothing else exists. So what kind of insanity is that?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I host space camps in the south of France every year where I train people in astronomy. And I have people coming from all over the world, and they often turn up with books that they're reading. And a lot of those books are copies. The text is a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. And I also host filmmaking masterclasses as well. Again, people come from New Zealand. They come from Australia. And again, they turn up with these books, and they're the text is a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. And they come here, and I've got a library of about 5,600 books, and I collect original or near original ancient texts. I've got, you know, books that go back to the pre-medieval era. And then, you know, we sit down and they're here for a week and, you know, I'm training them in astronomy or I'm training them in filmmaking. And I show them original texts and things. And it kind of, you know, shows them the root of where a lot of these ideas are stolen and plagiarized from. And it's amazing that they kind of go through a second awakening after they've been here. And I'm glad to have been able to help those people, because a lot of them would have ended up being more or less kind of sheep again. And instead of believing the dogma that they believed before, they're believing a different kind of dogma. They believe that, say, for example, the moon is made of titanium and it was manufactured by aliens and it's an artificial satellite or something like that. And then they come here, and then we study the moon, and we see the moon, and then they learn about the moon, and they actually see great detail in the moon for the first time using these giant telescopes. And, you know, it's a new awakening for them, because they realize, oh, really? Ah, yeah, that does exist. And it's not, you know, it's not a perception distortion. It's real, and it's been there for a long time. Thank God we have got it as well, because the moon has the surface that it's got because, I mean, it's got hundreds of thousands of craters simply because it acts like a Hoover, and it attracts comets and it attracts asteroids, and the asteroids hit the moon, thankfully, rather than coming to us. I mean, the asteroid that went through the sky of Russia just a few months ago, it actually exploded with the same kind of detonation power as the atomic bomb that hit Hiroshima in Japan in 1945. So, you know, and you can see the meteor crater in Flagstaff in Arizona. I mean, you just you don't want those things coming here, basically. And it's really good that we've got a moon like we have.
Indeed. And what I found that you said was quite interesting there is about how they, people believing fallacies, they wind up becoming followers again, right, rather than leading yourself, which is as you should do, you know, taking personal responsibility for your actions and so forth. It's akin to somebody who's a priest at the Church of Satan believing a whole lot of nonsense and doing evil stuff or whatever, you know, theoretically speaking, and then becoming a born-again Christian and then preaching to everybody that you're going to go to hell because the Catholic Church says so.
Yes, in actual fact, there are a lot of those types of people around who've been members of covens. Usually they get kind of hoodwinked into becoming a member. Some of them are actively seeking those kinds of brotherhoods. And I've met quite a lot of those people. I've interviewed people that were indoctrinated into Masonic brotherhoods. And then they realize, hang on a minute. You know, they think, hang on a minute, what did he say? And then they sort of, you know, they hear something and it triggers them to go off and do their own research. There's a great book called Freemasonry, Is It a Religion? And it's written by a former clergyman, a former priest. And it's a great little book. And I read that years and years and years ago. And the guy actually dissects what he was taught. And, you know, he comes to the conclusion that Freemasonry is not, you know, a society of butterfly collectors and innocent people. There's actually a thread that goes through that, that is actually, if you like, priming each Masonic temple through the hymns and the psalms which they sing and through the initiation ceremonies. Once all of those knife and fork kind of social Freemasons leave that temple, then there's new groups that come in, and they are much more serious, high-ranking magician-type Freemasons. And those groups are, you know, things like the Golden Dawn, which is still running to this day. You know, they've had many famous members. Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, Aleister Crowley, who was a part-time spy for Her Majesty's intelligence services, is Israel Regardi, who was an occult author who died just recently. You know, those high-ranking magical brotherhoods use the Masonic temples, usually in the middle of the night, after what I call the knife and fork social Freemasons have gone home. Now, that's what's going on.
Indeed, and I've interviewed one of the biggest Freemason whistleblowers since the late 1800s, James Wright. And he was 32nd degree. He was a paid kind of secretary for the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite in Dallas, Texas. And he was getting sexually propositioned by these married high-ranking Freemasons daily just because they knew he was gay. He was a witness and can account for numbers of really, really freaky rituals. And he's written two books on it. And then it turns out the publishers of his first book don't want a second book coming out because it's called The Filthy Rituals of Freemasonry Exposed. And it turns out that they belong to the Golden Dawn, who he also exposes in the book. And he didn't know this at the time. He was staying in, they gave him a car, you know, to get out of Dallas because he was under threat by the Masons there. And an apartment to live in with a security gate and all of that kind of stuff. And he couldn't quite figure out how on earth people were getting through a security gate all the time and leaving little symbols and sigils and things of that nature on the hood of his car that was parked inside the security gate, until he realized that these people were all working together. They only gave me somewhere to escape to so that they could monitor me.
Yes, well, they're not called brotherhoods for no reason. In the York Rite, which is, you know, a different flavor of Freemasonry to, you know, when you compare it to the Scottish Rite, I think it's the 11th or 13th degree. Each of these degrees is like an examination and initiation. In the York Rite, you swear to always stand behind a fellow brother, even if you know he is guilty of wrongdoing. Now, a lot of policemen are York Rite Freemasons, so where does that leave you? And then as they go up the initiatory scale of examinations and initiations, they get permission to kill their wife if they don't like her. So, it's not a good thing.
And of course, most Masons never even get above a couple of degrees anyway. They never hear about any of this kind of stuff, do they?
That's right. There is a big changeover between the fourth degree and the degrees above there. Most Masons become Master Masons. That's the third degree. And because it's got this grand title, Master Mason, they don't really bother to go any further. As you go up the levels of initiation, once you're beyond the 13th degree in the Scottish Rite tradition, there's a lot of Hebrew that you have to learn. It's like learning an individual separate language. There's hand gestures, there's postures, you know, there's different tools. You know, they're all symbolic tools, symbolic daggers, symbolic swords, symbolic hammers, set squares, kind of checkerboards or chessboards, all kinds of paraphernalia, different places you have to stand in the temple layout. And to be honest, a lot of those guys, they joined because their boss was a member. Or, you know, the local mayor who they wanted to be friendly with is a member. That's basically what drives the income. And Freemasonry is a business. And the Ordo Templi Orientis is a business. And the Golden Dawn is a business. These are all businesses based on money and membership and getting weekly dues, which are the weekly payments.
Well, how much would they be expected to pay? Do they pay more as they go up the scale? Or?
Yes, they do. It depends on the geographical location and the social standing of the members. I mean, if you have a little provincial lodge in the middle of nowhere, say in a little tiny village, they'll only pay about £3 a month. But some of the higher ranking lodges, they would expect £30 a month. So, you know, that's 10 times the amount.
But still not an extraordinary amount.
No, but if you consider that there's millions and millions and millions of these Masons, that money soon adds up every week.
Oh, so you're talking about £3 a week or £30 a week, not per month?
Well, yeah, I think the average in England is about 20-something pounds a month. And we have, I think, somewhere in the region of between 3.5 and 5 million Freemasons in the United Kingdom.
Just think, you could either be a Freemason or you could have digital television by satellite.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they, the United Grand Lodge has got probably somewhere in the region of about, this is a pretty accurate guesstimate, I would say, it's probably got somewhere in the region of between 11 and 25 million pounds a month coming in.
Sweet Mother of Mercy. What on earth do they do with all this money?
Well, they have their big buildings. they, you know, they obviously maintain their own lifestyles. They have libraries and they have a good life. The people at the top of Freemasonry, you know, they're pretty okay financially.
And is there any skullduggery involving the business kind of thing? Because I've always found that with with groups that are able to keep secrets within themselves, they often wind up doing business with a whole bunch of other different groups in many different sectors of society without that being found out either.
Well, when I made my first Illuminati documentary, it's just called The Illuminati. I made that in 2004. I investigated the biggest gold bullion robbery in history, which is called the Brinks-Matt Bullion Raid. And I discovered that the guy organizing the gang was a Freemason. And then I discovered which lodge he was a member of. And then I discovered that the guy who was in charge at the Serious Fraud Office of investigating the Brinks-Matt Bullion Gang was a Freemason as well. And he was a member of the exact same lodge. And then I found out that they were friends. so, you know, unfortunately, that's the kind of things that go on.
Well, I guess it's, I was just thinking about, funnily you should mention this in criminality. I was just thinking about, have you ever been friends with criminals, right? Like people who actually kind of commit crimes for a living or met these kind of people, and you know, whether would they be, I don't know, they've robbed houses before or they're a drug dealer or something of that nature. I find that they're always really guarded and often they have somebody to back them up, right? They don't like going things alone. And
I don't really mix in those types of circles, but crime and criminality, it comes in all shapes and sizes, and it's pretty obvious from the revelations of Mr. Snowden that the royal corporate political elite, they consider everyone as being either a terrorist or a potential terrorist, because in his latest revelations, he says that the National Security Agency is actually tracking 5.1 billion smartphones. Well, that's probably every phone that's out there, because about 2 billion people live in abject poverty on this planet. And there's 7.3 billion people on the planet. And there's 5.1 billion phones every 24 hours being tracked.
And I can guarantee you, some of them people have got multiple phones on them, don't they?
Some people do, yeah.
Yeah.
That's very true.
I can never fathom that. Why would you need, like, 8 phones?
I know, it's strange, isn't it? I mean, I know my nephews. You know, my nephew, he pulled an iPhone out of his pocket, and I thought, wow, I was very impressed. He's only 14. And, and I said, wow, you know, I haven't even got an iPhone. That's amazing that you've got one of those. And then he pulled a BlackBerry out of his other pocket and said, I've got one of those as well. It's just amazing.
What do you call a cell phone you can stab people with?
No idea.
A knife phone.
Very good.
You know, I've got this idea. Like, I've interviewed a number of people about smart meters and EMF, electricity, radiation, pollution, that kind of thing recently.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like now we're currently bathing in this unbelievable atmosphere of just crap, assault in our bodies and our immune systems and everything at all times. I feel like I'm stressed, like I'm under attack constantly.
Well, yeah, well, that's very true. That's been going on for a long time. I've actually made a film called Spirit World, and I made that in 2007. And you know, I discuss this cocoon of spiritual energy, which was accepted as being a real aspect of nature by all of the great philosophers and all of the great scientists in the ancient world. And it's called the ether. And Tesla believed in it. And everyone believed in the ether until Einstein came along. And he kind of changed people's perceptions of the ether. But the ether was written into textbooks. When you, studied physics, you had to study the ether. And the ether is this cocoon of energy. It covers the entire planet. It's like the layers of an onion. And now, of course, we call it the Higgs field, because Einstein kind of came in and he changed the rules a little bit in physics, and he came up with special relativity and several other thought experiments, which people, you know, kind of more or less they've confirmed everything that he was putting down into his writings. And Einstein and Niels Bohr and Oppenheimer and many of these leading figures in physics and nuclear physics, they come from Hebrew families. And of course, Hebrew families often have books of the Kabbalah and the Merkaba, and the Merkaba type texts like the Zohar, the Book of Light, in their family libraries. And if you look at modern physics, and especially if you look at quantum physics, and you look at the research into the Higgs field and the Higgs boson, you can see that what they're actually teaching is a kind of modern version of the Kabbalah, where in the Zohar you have 10 spheres, and each of these spheres is a kind of zone, if you like. And as you go from one sphere to the next, matter becomes denser and denser and heavier until you get to the final sphere, and that's our planet, and that's reality. And that is what really basically quantum physics is. It's a kind of modern reinterpretation of the Kabbalistic worldview of the astral world, the invisible realms, and the physical realms.
Is there any validity to that Kabbalistic interpretation of reality?
Well, that's what they're doing. They're going through a process of validating the Kabbalah and redressing it and repackaging it as nuclear physics, quantum physics, and classical physics.
That's pretty messed up thinking there.
Well, you know, I don't know. You know, the spirit world obviously does exist. I mean, yeah. I don't recommend any of the listeners do this or any of the viewers do this, but, you know, I've just spent 3 years and I'm still in the process of making Spirit World 3, which is the third made-for-cinema documentary about paranormal research. And in my film, I've been given permission for the very first time to take my cameras inside all kinds of temples while rituals are going on. This is very rare. You never see this kind of thing. And in my film, you know, you can actually see a Hebrew Ouija board seance, and it's taking place in Jerusalem, and very silly. I know it's so stupid. What they did is that they decided to call the spirit of Lucifer and Satan to speak to them via the Ouija board.
Oh, that's a wise idea.
Yeah. And in my film, you can see that they get completely freaked out. People start, really just basically going into shock. And they take their hands and their fingers off of the glass, but the glass continues moving. Not only does it move off of the board, it moves onto the floor and it continues moving across the floor, and it's got so much spirit force in it, it actually knocks over a can of drink. And, you know, this film, Spirit World 3, it's taken me a long time to actually make it. It's two main reasons is that, first of all, these types of groups don't like me coming in there with my camera. And it takes a long time to convince them, and I have to show them my original films and gradually gain their trust. And the second reason is that a lot of loonies and I suppose you could call them, you know, psychiatric casualty type people who've been on the fringe of these occult groups and who see me as an enemy because I'm exposing this and I'm actually doing broadcasts like this, Vinny, all the time. They see me as the enemy because, you know, none of these secret groups can really survive that long with somebody like me around where I expose all their secrets. And they've done everything they can to try and stop me from making this new Spirit World film. But I've continued to the point where I'm going into like the third stage of production now. And I've re-edited and added new material and I've remastered the film 3 times now. Because people keep coming forward to me and giving me new information. And I've actually got footage for the very first time of actual rituals going on. So I'm pleased with the film. It's got some distance to go yet in its production.
May I ask, what compels you to put so much into this field of research and everything that it is that you do? Because I thought about this myself, what compels me to do what I do the other day.
Yeah.
And it's about, ultimately, I admitted to myself, it's about justifying my existence. You know, I have to do something good with my life.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would agree with that, absolutely. I mean, I enjoy learning about things. I certainly enjoy traveling. I go to, you know, every single corner of the planet, and I very much enjoy that. I'm a people person. I enjoy meeting people. I do it full time. There's nothing else that I do. And at heart, I'm really basically an investigative journalist and author. I make films because the visual documentaries, when they go out into the independent cinemas, and they usually play in late shows, my types of films, I like it because a film is able to deliver a huge amount of information in that 2-hour period in the dark to a large group of people who are sitting in the cinema. Whereas when I write my books, that's a different kind of way of disseminating the information, because when you read a book, it's a personal relationship between the reader and the author. So, you know, I enjoy doing it, basically. But I want to improve the situation. I want to flush out of the system not only the corrupt politicians, but also all of these kind of weird savior, guru, messiah type people that I've interviewed in the past, which I feel are just really taking things way too far now. And they need to be reined in by common sense and logic, because they, like I said earlier in the broadcast, they don't have any knowledge of ancient languages or even modern foreign languages, and it's all copied out of other books, and it's like Chinese whispers, and a lot of people are being misled. And I think one of the other incentives is that I do see people trying to make a difference, and they're making films the same as I make films, but they haven't quite got it. They haven't quite worked out that there is really basically only, I'd say, three factions running the entire geopolitical situation on the planet. And they make their films, and there's some really good films that have been stuck out on these video sharing websites. But they're like watching a bunch of political scientist kind of students. And they've got good ideas. I mean, the Zeitgeist movement's got good ideas, really good. I mean, the resource-based economy idea based on sharing the resources of the planet is an excellent idea. And it's something which I'd like to see happen. And I think Peter Joseph, he's got his heart is definitely in the right place. There's no question about it. Unfortunately, of course, is that the royal elite who've been in charge for centuries upon centuries, who monopolize uranium, monopolize diamonds, gold, sapphires, emeralds, oil, gas. They're not interested in sharing. They're not interested in sharing any of those resources, which is kind of overlooked in Peter's films, unfortunately. But that's not his fault. But that's just the way it is, you know.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because I just watched Success or Oblivion. I think that's the name of it. A documentary done about Jacques Fresco and the Venus Project and these models and different cities and all of these kind of things. And I'm inclined to agree with you that absolutely this looks like a brilliant idea for a future. You know, it's got a few hobnobs here and there that I don't like the look of, but look at the whole picture versus what we've got currently as a whole picture. And there's certainly a heck of a lot of a better alternative. And Fresco even says in it, this is not perfection. I don't think we'll ever even achieve it. This is just a hell of a lot better than whatever we've got going on now.
Yes.
But again, and I want to back up your point, when you're looking at a cancerous body, there's two things you've got to do. You've got to inject some health into that body, and you've got to get rid of the cancer, right?
Yes.
What these people are talking about doing is putting health into the body without getting rid of the cancer. It will just continue to grow and metastasize.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. I mean, Mr. Fresco, I've seen his designs. I studied architecture as well at Celtec in London, which is like one of the leading construction architectural. I mean, they teach everything. They teach even basic things like bricklaying. And, you know, I was going to be a doctor, and To be honest, you know, I saw the holes through the medical mafia system very early on, and I'm very glad that I didn't actually follow through with it. So in the end, I signed up to this architectural course, architecture and construction. I'm glad I did. Mr. Fresco does have designs which resemble the kind of boys' own almanacs that I used to read when I was like 7 or 8 years old, Cities of the Future. And it's a very good idea to have modern facilities and to, you know, have a modern, egalitarian, equal, beautiful and clean environment. Unfortunately, he's gone down the route of those types of 19, you know, the view of what, you know, the Venus Project reminds me of books published in the 1950s that had drawings of what life would be like in 1975, where we would all have our own private flying saucers and we'd wear these biodegradable kind of all-in-one spacesuits, and we'd have, you know, microwaves, and we'd eat, like, you know, perfectly nutritious pills. That idea and those ideas that became very popular were basically, you know, doable. They are doable. And we could have had, you know, a much better infrastructure in most of our cities by now. Of course, the Illuminati, and when I say the Illuminati, I'm talking about all the different factions of the Illuminati. I'm talking about the royal, the political, and the corporate factions. they seem to be having a great time forcing mankind to be competitive. And this competitive aspect to human society and the fiscal world, the financial world, has kind of stolen the future away, you know. I mean, the modern trains which we have now in, say, for example, the United Kingdom, you know, they're very nice inside and everything. You know, they're decorated nicely. But those modern trains are running on railway tracks that were paid for from the taxes of our great-grandparents. You know, I mean, you know, we really do need to rip up and throw away the old style designs that are holding back the future. And what's holding it back is investment and finance and competition and profits, which is very unfortunate. But, you know, I think that the European and the Russian and the American factions will come a cropper eventually, because the Oriental world in terms of technology is racing ahead. I mean, they have floating magnetic levitating trains in the Oriental world already.
Now, I also, something interesting here, we're talking about finance and capital. There was an article released, I forget who, but it was something along the lines of a number of extraordinarily wealthy billionaires, like over 100 of them, that gave the vast majority of their fortunes away to charities. The problem is all of these charities that they gave them to, none of them do any infrastructure projects.
Oh, I see. That's a great pity. I think most of the foundations, especially the foundations set up by former presidents, like political presidents, like the Clinton Foundation, things like that.
Ford Foundation.
They are basically receptacles of money that would otherwise end up in the actual tax system, because many countries have a situation where if you give a pound to a charitable non-profit organization, that's a pound less from your tax bill. So rather than having a $40 million tax bill at the end of the year, they set up a foundation and give $40 million to the foundation.
Now, it's interesting as well, because the perspective's kind of skewed here when people talk about taxes. in New Zealand just yesterday, the New Zealand Herald put out benefit fraud was $39 million last year, whereas tax dodging was $1 billion last year. Okay.
Yes.
And they treat the tax dodging as like, oh, it's nothing, you know, and they treat the $39 million benefit fraud as, oh my God, how terrible.
Yes, of course, because it's war on the working classes. That's why.
Yeah. And my perspective is all the taxes are illegal anyway. So what the government's doing is just crying out about how people are stealing the money they stole from them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's be honest. Tax is not about running the services of the state. It's about a weapon which is used against the working classes. Once you've got £1 million, you've got enough spare money to pay a small army of very clever accountants, and you'll never pay a penny in tax. I mean, very, very large corporations that are turning over billions aren't paying very much tax at all. Google was just investigated by the Parliamentary Accounts Committee of Her Majesty's Parliament because they're running this thing called a Dutch sandwich, which is shifting literally.
It sounds like some kind of sexual favor.
It does sound a bit suggestive, but they're moving billions of pounds around the planet to avoid giving Her Majesty her cut. I mean, you know,
so she can heat Buckingham Palace.
The what, sorry?
So she can heat Buckingham Palace. There was an article that came out of the Daily Mail saying that the Queen said, "I want to take $10 million out of the UK's poverty fund so that I can heat my palaces that I don't live in."
Yeah, well, that says it all, doesn't it? You know, I mean, look, we don't need to pay a single penny in tax to run a beautiful system. If we had governments that had invested properly the tax paid by our great, great, great grandparents and all the generations before us, then they would have built up a massive nest egg, and that nest egg would generate interest, which would pay for everyone on the planet to have a wonderful life. But they haven't done it. I mean, the government shutdown that we've just experienced in the USA, what a joke. I mean, you know, I'm an astronomer. I went to the NASA website and there was a sign on there saying, you know, this site isn't available because of the government shutdown. What a joke. I mean, you know, they're giving you the impression that the administration is running hand to mouth. As soon as Congress stops giving them the money, they shut down the whole of the government. This is proof that every single penny and every single cent that's ever been stolen from the wage packets of our ancestors has been squandered. You know, I mean, what's going on here? So that's my view about taxation. You know, it's just, it's a weapon, and it's as simple as that. And it's only the working classes that pay it.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, I think that wraps it up for a good first hour of this interview, Chris. And one thing we did forget is to plug your website.
Yes, well, I have many. My personal website is christopherevarard.com. You can watch the Enigma channel. You can sign up for a free account. It's enigmatv.com, enigmatv.com. It doesn't exist on YouTube or anywhere else, though. People who purport to be me are usually weirdos and cult members or even intelligence agencies, because I make documentaries that tell people what the intelligence agencies are really doing. So that's enigmatv.com. And you have to be very careful if you look for me on Facebook. There's at least 7 or 8 fake versions of me at any one time. And you can also check out my book. I write books. My latest book is called Stone Age Psychedelia, and you can go to stoneagepsychedelia.com.
Excellent. We'll be right back, folks.